if you have a vision on where you want to go, you know, you can achieve it. It's just a question of finding the way to navigate your way through it, regardless of what age you are.
You're listening to Over the Wall, where we bring you in-depth conversations with some of today's greatest visionaries to help you master the mental game of entrepreneurship. I'm your host, Rob LoCascio. Hi, everyone. It's Rob LoCascio, and welcome to another edition of Over the Wall. Today, I'm here with Michael Clinton. Michael was publisher of Hearst magazine. He's a writer, a photographer, led GQ magazine in the 90s, just had an amazing career in publishing and continues. He's an advisor to the CEO of Hearst, Stephen Schwartz. And more importantly, he just put out a book called Roar. And the reason I wanted to have him on the program is he really talks about second acts, and more than that, change. And, you know, the show is really about making the change, not going down a path you don't want to. And so I thought it'd be great to bring him on and listen to him and hear, you know, why do you write the book and what is this, some of the lessons he can share with us. So, Michael, welcome to the show.
Rob, thank you so much. It's great to be with you. Great to be here with you and all of your listeners and viewers.
So maybe you can just tell us a little bit, you know, I like to start kind of like, who are you? And because the book's pretty amazing, but like there's a build up to get there and why you wrote it. And maybe I couldn't find much out about your childhood. And right. We had some people, I had this guy, Klaus Meyer, and he talked about his dad and this relationship he had with his dad. It was not so good, but it shaped his life. And I always like to start with childhoods. And maybe you can tell me, like, where'd you grow up? What was your childhood like? You know, how'd you get into publishing? Like,
yeah, thanks, Rob. You know, I was born and raised in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, to a working class family. My father was a laborer. My mother was a housewife. And I was the oldest of six kids. And so we were not a lot of advantages, not a lot of educational history in the family. My parents were high school graduates. About, you know, that was about it. But my dad, who the book is dedicated to, dad will be 89 next month, and we'll be celebrating his 89th birthday. My dad was someone who was very curious about the world. He knew a lot about, you know, events, current events, political events. He was interested in history and art, and he really was the one who exposed us. I love to tell the story. Every Friday night, as a family, we would go to the local library, and we were able to take out five books for the week. And so I would get the books and I would pretty much have them finished by Sunday. But he taught me about words and about ideas and that there was a bigger life out there. So as the first one in my family history to go to college and study economics and political science, when I was at the University of Pittsburgh, I ultimately became the publisher of the university newspaper. And it was my eureka moment where I said, I like this publishing thing. And, you know, you have to go to New York City to go strike it out. $60 in my pocket, you know, no contacts, a couch to sleep on for a couple of weeks. And I began the journey. And I had a great 40-year run. I ended up ultimately as the president and publishing director of Hearst Magazines. I got to launch Oprah's Magazine, HGTV, Food Network, published Esquire. You mentioned I was the publisher of GQ. So I'm one of those rare birds that I ended up spending my entire career in magazine publishing because it was a great run for me. So that's a bit of my background.
So, you know, I've had like, I was talking to Deepak Chopra and Scott Kelly, and I've asked them, you know, some things like what's super shocking or interesting that nobody would know about. They're interesting. And obviously in publishing, you know, what's the thing that you probably didn't expect that maybe happened, you know, as you were in the industry that maybe shaped you, good or bad, that you found out about it?
Yeah, well, you know, it's a little intimidating to come to New York City, you know, as a young person and trying to break into the big media world, especially when you don't have any connections. And what I found was that good old fashioned hard work, dedication, loyalty, mentors, some luck and some timing is an alchemy that if you have a vision on where you want to go, you know, you can achieve it. It's just a question of finding the way to navigate your way through it, regardless of what age you are. And so I think that what I learned is that many, many people who are more talented and senior than me sort of recognized something in me and moved me along and gave me opportunities. And, you know, I became the youngest publisher in the industry at GQ when I was 34. So it's kind of heady stuff for a 34-year-old kid from Pittsburgh. But, you know, I had to get comfortable in the shoes, but I also had to make sure I wasn't getting, and we should talk about this, that I wasn't getting seduced by the seat. Because the seat is a very, you know, we all sit in a seat. And if our name is not on the door, we're all renters of that seat. And so I had to sort of keep it in check with all the, you know, heady stuff that I got to experience in that seat and more.
So did you ever feel, you know, we talked about this, like imposter syndrome, because when you're very young, you're sitting in the seat. This is a big role. I mean, were the days where you woke up and said, like, I don't know what I'm doing here. Like, this is like, or did you always have this confidence with it? Did you have any doubt?
Yeah, you know, I think I grew into it and I didn't really have any doubt on it. And what I ultimately learned, you know, as I was meeting, you know, literally presidents of the United States and also, you know, celebrities and sports stars and sitting down with Cary Grant when he was on the cover of GQ and Michael Jordan and others, that regardless of what you achieve in life, people are people and there's always a human element that you can connect to them with. And I found that gave me sort of a comfort zone. There was always, I remember sitting next to Paul McCartney once at a lunch and I'm like, what the heck am I going to talk to Paul McCartney about? I mean, he's like, you know, mega. And I asked him, it was very funny. He had just become knighted. And I said, I'm just curious, do they have Sir Paul McCartney on your American Express card? And he said, I don't know, let me look. And he took out his wallet and put out his card and it sort of broke the ice and we got into a great conversation. So I think people, you know, connect on the human level. And I found that to be sort of a secret sauce. I can now talk to anybody, anywhere.
You were talking about mentors. And I mean, I often say on the show, like finding a mentor, people also ask me like, how do you find a mentor and all that? Was there one or two specific ones you had in your life and what did they impart on you, you know, especially when you were starting out about, you know, you know, what you could do with your life.
Yeah, I always say that you should adopt a mentor. You know, find that person who you really admire, who you really see as a great problem solver, a visionary, all the above. And I was very lucky. I adopted a mentor early in my career, a guy named Jack Klieger, who is still a very good friend. Jack was the publisher of GQ, and I was his number two, and he basically mentored me into his role. I ultimately became C-suite in my former publishing company, Condé Nast, and that was with Jack. I ultimately then became the chairman of the Magazine Publishers of America, once again, thanks to Jack, because he had the role. So he's still a friend to this day, an advisor. And so I think adopting a mentor is really critical. But I also think that it's important when you're in midlife and older to do reverse mentoring, to adopt a 25-year-old and find out what's going on in their world and their head. So, yeah, adopting a mentor to me is really the headline.
Was there a couple of words of wisdom or things that you remember he gave to you, you know, that then you would pass along to somebody else? What were some key things you were told?
Well, he was the guy that taught me about the seat and not getting too hung up and too self-defined in the seat. There's a chapter in the book all about life layering, which was sort of the outgrowth of that conversation with him, that while a seat provides you with lots of amazing experiences, I mean, I've been to Super Bowls and Oscars and Oscar parties and Grammys and all that stuff, but it's not because of me. It's because of the seat that I sat in. And so we have to all build other identities for ourselves so that when we step out of the seat, we don't go off a cliff, but rather we have developed all of these identities. You rattled a few off when you introduced me. I mean, I would, you know, people say, well, what did you do after you stepped out of that seat? Well, you know, I'm an author and I'm an adventure traveler and I'm a marathon runner and I'm a photographer And I went back to school and got a master's degree at Columbia. I'm a student. You know, I had a whole list of other self-identities. And, you know, when I moved out of the seat, it was like, that was phenomenal. That was a great run. But it's now it's time to go on and do something else with all these other identities I had developed over, you know, 20, 25 years.
But it's hard. Like that's a pretty big thing to do, because like you get very involved in your seat. Your own, you know, especially like, once again, we have a lot of entrepreneurs that are, you know, they're just focused down on, right, you know, staying alive or building their companies or building bigger. I mean, how do you discipline yourself? You know, how do you create those layers in a way that have some meaning to them? Because obviously what you've done, these are meaningful layers. Why did you develop it? How'd you develop it? And how do you keep it going?
Well, you know, I developed it because I thought at one point I was the most boring human being on the planet. You know, I had a great job and I had a great family life, but I was completely defined by my job. And I said, this is dangerous turf, because a lot of people, and I hate to pick on my gender, but a lot of men in particular have this issue where they're so wrapped up in their professional seat, whether they're an entrepreneur or whether they work for a company. And so I picked something. I knew I always had this adventure streak in me. So when I was turning 40, I picked three things that I wanted to do. I wanted to climb Mount Kilimanjaro. I wanted to take a flying lesson. And I went to the race car driving school at Skip Barber in Connecticut. And I ultimately became a pilot. And I ultimately climbed up many other mountains. But this adventure thing became my thread for my layer, because I said my 40s are going to be my adventure years. And I kept building on that layer. And so here I am, you know, 25 plus years later, I've built this enormous adventure layer trips in me, et cetera, so that people always come to me and say, wow, you've been to 124 countries. You've hiked in Bhutan and Nepal and Patagonia. And how have you fit it all in? I said, well, I've done it over 25 years. So pick something. And I like to say to people, pick something that's either core to something you love, or go back to your younger self. What did you give up when you were a teenager into your 20s, into school? Did you want to be a musician or a writer or a painter or, you know, an anthropologist? What was it that turned you on? Go back and find that thread and start building that as your first layer.
So let's dig a little into the book and some ideas about this kind of redoing life.
Yeah.
And why don't you explain the concept and, sure, and you know, what does this mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the book, it came out of this notion that everything I was reading that was out there and any research or anything that I watched was all about the big wind down. You know, when you hit 60, it was all about the big wind down. And, you know, I was like, this is not the way the world is really moving. I want to know about the big wind up. Because if you're 50 or you're 60 and you're healthy, you're going to probably live to be 90. You know, is a good shot at it. Stanford just put out a paper last week or two that the five-year-old today who gets the right kind of prenatal and postnatal medical care to set them on their life journey, 50% of them have the opportunities to live to be 100. So we are moving into the 100-year life cycle. Every day, 10,000 people are turning 65. In 2030, 1 in 5 Americans will be 65. And many of those people, especially those on the younger boomer end, are rejecting the script that they were handed. The script they were handed is something that was created in the 1940s when life expectancy was 60 and you would work and retire and die a few years later. And now, you know, you can have a second career, you can launch a new business. You know, the fastest growing cohort of entrepreneurs, 25% are actually now 55 to 64. So a lot of resources, experience, and money that group has, launching businesses, starting new careers. One of the people, I interviewed 40 people in the book who I call them the reimagineers. These are all people who were, let's say, early 40s to mid 60s, who did a complete 180, launched a new career, started a new business, created a new lifestyle, created a new relationship, and how they did it. And, you know, what was really interesting is that it's across the spectrum, all socioeconomic backgrounds, because you can do it regardless of where you've come from. So I wanted to create the counter story to what is the construct of, you know, what we're supposed to do. So one of the things we took on in the book, and I'll get into the acronym, is we, you know, instead of saying midlife crisis, let's call it midlife awakening.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you've now lived 25 years and you're like, I know a lot about myself. So let's call it an awakening. Instead of age appropriate, let's call it person appropriate, because people are becoming parents at 50. They're, as I said, launching businesses at 60, falling in love again at 80. You know, there's this new arc of possibility that the younger boomers are going to shake it up and start putting the new template in place, and the next generations are going to refine it. So Gen X, Gen Y in particular, they will refine what this new second half of life looks like. So ROAR, so the concept that was developed was ROAR. It's a four parts. R is reimagine and what's your favorite future. O is own your numbers, own where you come from, you know, own your physical well-being, your financial well-being. A is the action plan. Here's how you do it. And R is the reassessment of your relationships. And so the book is filled with not only inspirational stories, but lots of tips and resources and how-tos that give people sort of a map and a template to create and pivot, not just at 40, but even at 30. I've got all these 30-year-olds who come forward and said, I love your book. It's giving me a roadmap of what I can do in the future. So I think it's a little bit of age agnostic.
That's what I think too. And it maybe gives some, there's some interesting, you did a survey, yeah, right? And you got all this great data on people kind of being happy in relationships or work. And I thought it was some pretty good data. Maybe you can share some of the big aha from the survey.
Well, one of the biggest aha was, you know, this notion of if you could change a major event in your life in the past, would you? And 70% said they would, which was interesting. But the message of the book is, you know, don't get hung up in woulda, coulda, shoulda, you know, move forward. But the number one thing that people wrote in on, because there was a write-in section, is they said, you know, I would have rethought who I married or my current relationship, which I thought was really profound. Because if you think about, let's just pick the average person gets married at 25, and then all of a sudden they're 55, and 30 years later, they've either have grown with that person or have not. And, you know, then they're sort of saying, well, if I'm 55 and I'm going to live to be 90, do I want to be with this person for the next 35 years? You know, and so, that's like a big eye opener. But the second thing that came out was I wish I had done more with my education. And I think that the stories in the book, there are so many people in the book who at midlife have decided to go back to school, and not necessarily for degrees, but for certificates or for something through the MOOC system, which you might be familiar with, Mass Open Online Courses. And there's an enormous amount of money for people at midlife to get scholarships and get support. And many universities, by the way, in different states, like Georgia, if you're 62, you can go to university for free. And so there are a lot of possibilities of getting new skills, education. But one of the messages in the book is don't restrict yourself. Go for it. Go take a new educational journey of some sort.
So when you think about people making change, and a lot of the show is about change, it's hard. Yeah. So most people, like you said, they unfortunately get to the end of life. They may come upon your survey and go, I wish I could have, but right, kind of it's over. Yeah. In many ways, even. And so first of all, why do people get stuck? You know, like of all the possibilities that you could do in this age and date, and obviously we've been maybe conditioned, but why do people get stuck and why don't people leave? Why don't people move?
Yeah. Good question. I think people get stuck because they don't do the hard work as to what it is that is really eating at them and gnawing at them. And everybody that I interviewed, once again, spent 1 to 2 years in sort of a deep personal inventory as to where, what part of their life they were not happy with. And by the way, even if they are happy, ultimately change is going to be forced on you. You may become an empty nester and all of a sudden you wake up and you say, what am I going to do with all this time now that I used to give to my kids? And so change is going to come upon you whether you want change or not. So you have to think about how you're going to navigate that. So spending the deep time to do it. What I like to say and what I learned.
Have you done the work?
I've definitely done it. Yes, yes. I did the work when I knew I was going to step out of my career. And, you know, I was making the choice that I was sort of done. It was 42 years. It was wonderful, incredible. But I spent a couple of years thinking through what it was that I was going to do. And one of the decisions, I love being a lifelong learner, being a student. So one of the decisions I made was to go back to university, which was a little daunting at 60 something, to go back to school and write papers and take tests. 12 courses. It was a master's degree in nonprofit philanthropy, which is a subject I'm passionate about. I'm on a lot of nonprofit boards. So I made the decision to go back to school, which was a great sort of, I'm finished now. I'm a proud graduate at 67 years old. So I decided, you know, I would end up writing this book. And then, of course, you know, COVID hit just at the time when I stepped out of the seat. So you know, ended up doing school and writing the book and at a home office and, you know, didn't get to do much global traveling and stuff. But I had a really good thought out plan as to what I was going to do. And part of that, you know, your audience may be familiar with the SWOT analysis that we all know for business. And I always say to people, do a personal SWOT analysis. That's one thing. The second thing I always say is ask 10 people around you, your close-ins, your spouse, your partners, your parents, your kids, your friends, what do you think I'm good at? What do you think, when you think of me, what do you really think that I'm, what comes off of my vibe that I'm really good at? And it's really interesting what you get. There's a great story in the book of a woman who was an elementary school teacher in suburban Georgia. And everybody around her said, "You are so funny. You're like the funniest person I know. And you should go do an open mic session at a comedy club." And she had no idea what that meant. And her daughter took her to this place in Atlanta. And to make a long story short, this woman is now a stand-up comic full time. And she works the circuit. You know, it's so you know, it came out of that sort of talking to the people around her. And also, we all know that thing inside of us that we were always, you know, curious about or interested in, and we kind of left it on the shelf. So another story is a woman, she was a longtime sales executive in her late 50s. She realized that she'd always wanted to be a writer, and she ended up taking lots of classes and master class and wanted to become a mystery writer. And she ended up having 170 rejections from a book that she wrote. And she finally got a publisher, and the book was a bit of a hit. And she's now on her fifth book, and she's 66. And she said, "I'm a novelist." But she went back to find an early passion that she had given up. So those are some of the tips that I say go into deep.
So we talk about that because we talked about all different times in the show that it's kind of like we have this, maybe we've been put on earth with a purpose. And it seems when we're kids, everything seems possible. And then somewhere through life, we think that's silly. I can't be an author.
Right.
I can't be an astronaut. I can't be a salesperson. Whatever it is, you know, everyone's got to. And somehow we get in our head and then we end up somewhere else. And I assume because of all the research you did with the book and everything, there's this period of time. And we try to understand like why. Why do we do that to ourselves? Why not just take the path? But why do you think that is, since you interviewed all these 40 people and you know, did the surveys, and why is that we don't take the path?
Yeah, well, we listen to other people who want, and oftentimes when we're young, it's our parents. or our aunts or uncles or our elders who say, you can't be an anthropologist. That's not practical. You have to study accounting. I'm just making that up.
Yeah.
Because you'll be able to get a job if you're an accountant or a teacher, or you can't be an actor because, you know, that's a crazy notion. And so what happens is we end up living other people's lives and we give it up. And what happens is, and it's very interesting, there's a guy named Rob Smith in the book. His father said, I'll only pay for college if you study business. And Rob wanted to be a social worker. And he studied business and he had a 25-year business career, very successful. And at 50, he had a meltdown and he took a leave of absence. And one of the things, he went to Burning Man, he went to all sorts of places. And he ended up doing an ayahuasca ceremony in Peru, which you might be familiar with, the hallucinogenic plant.
Yeah.
And he said he was sitting on a rock and he looked across this body of water and he saw his 16-year-old self. And he said, I'm so sorry that I abandoned you. And he came back and he quit his job and he launched a nonprofit in the social justice space, which is now 5-6 years old. And I think that the number one headline that I've heard is, you know, I wish I had been more true to myself. I wish I had followed my own North Star. I wish I had not been influenced by. And my message in the book is, okay, you're now 45 or you're 50 or 55. You can make a U-turn. You can do it because unlike your parents and your grandparents, you have a long arc ahead of you. So, you know, at 50 or 55, you don't have 10 more years. You have 30 more years.
Right.
So, you know, when you have that aha moment, you say, okay, I can do this. And this is a lot of the stories are obviously the people who've done it. And, you know, I think more and more of these kind of role models are who we will all need to see in order to facilitate the change that we want in our lives.
But I love this concept that look back into your 16-year-old self.
Yeah.
Like, I think this is a great, if you could just look there. I mean, if you want to do ayahuasca, you could do that too. But go and look at your 16-year-old self and write down, you know, maybe that's part of the work you're saying, reflective work is, What would I want to be? And am I that person? And if not, then why is that? Or maybe it doesn't matter why. It's just that what do I need to do to move forward? Because it's never too late. That's kind of what you're trying to say.
Yeah, that's true. The you know, since I'm in the publishing business, you know, I always like I always have two things that I like to say that are metaphors for life. One is edit. We live in a world of editing and in publishing. And so edit out extraneous things that don't have meaning or matter to you, that don't bring you joy or purpose. And editing is really a great process in all aspects of your life. And we all know how we waste time and or we don't spend time in things that are really important to us. And I've got some funny anecdotes in the book about my own personal view of my own editing process. And so to me, that is really good. And the other thing is as a publisher and a writer, is I believe in writing things down. And what I do, which is my little trick, is I put together a life journal every year. It's January is the life journal, and it's across all the categories that I'm interested in, family, friends, fitness, life, et cetera, et cetera. And I check on it the first week of every month. And I'm like, okay, what progress have I made in, like, if I want to learn Italian and it is June and I've done nothing to learn Italian, then who am I, who is the person that you have to blame? Yourself. So, you know, it sort of sifts out what you're really going to pursue and you're interested in versus what you're really not going to pursue. You know, I have a friend who always says he wants to run a half marathon and he's barely run 2 miles ever. So I'm like, you really aren't going to run that half marathon. You should take that off your list and off your brain because it ain't happening. So, you know, we say things that we want to do, but we don't keep ourselves accountable for getting it done.
Yeah.
Writing it down in a good way.
Do the same thing at the end of every year. I look back at the previous years. I break between family and giving and health and business. And then and then I used to write myself a letter. Someone told me, Stricker, write yourself a letter like, and then mail it to someone. I used to mail it to my best friend, and then have him or her mail it back to you at a year later and see what you actually achieved. And we did this to each other for many years. And I had a friend who, same thing, used to say I was going to run a marathon, didn't really run it. And you'd see he didn't really do a lot. And I was pretty close to my goals, but even some things I forgot, you know? So yeah. It's interesting. If you write it down, you write the some power of it in your brain. And if you make some organization, because you almost have to create pretty clear goals to get through the year, right?
Absolutely. That's a brilliant idea. I may steal that idea about the letter. There is a lot of work in the neuroscience world and academics about how our brain is still wired to write things down and or read things on paper, not on the screen, but on the paper. The human brain is still wired to absorb more and retain more through the process of writing down and paper, which is interesting. A lot of work's been done. But you've got to keep yourself accountable in that way, because it will keep you focused on, you know, where you're going to go and what you want to do. The other thing I like to say to people who, and I've been doing a lot of talks around the country, and I've been talking to all sorts of organizations, from corporations and associations and financial service agencies and their clients. And the one thing I like to say to a, let's call it a 50 to 60 year old, is as part of this process, go to 90 and write your life story. Who were you? What did you do? What did you accomplish? What is your legacy? What did you, you know, what are the things that are important for you that you leave as an imprint on your family, your kids, your community, all of that? And you don't have to be a Nobel Prize winner to do that. You can be an everyday person, because the impact that we have on each other is meaningful. And so what is it that you've done? I have a little bit of a morbid habit. I like reading obituaries because they're like mini biographies.
Yeah, they are. I like them too. I'm always like,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just happened to read one this weekend about a woman who's 95 years old, who I sort of knew tangentially. And she was in the advertising business, in the agency business. And when I read it, I was like, wow. And like, she was named like one of the most influential women in the world back in the 1960s and 70s. And, you know, the influence that she had in her core career was really spectacular when I read this little mini obit. And I think it's always interesting to see what people do with their lives, and inspirational. So, yeah.
So it's kind of interesting, because I think if we look at, if we bookend this a little bit of like, you got the 16-year-old self and the 90-year-old self, and you can look at those two things, it's quite interesting. Once again, I'm trying to work on where do I start to work? Edit out things in your life that you think are not giving you joy, pleasure, you know, not helping you move forward. But that 90-year-old, 16-year-old perspective are pretty interesting guideposts to, are you really on your path of what? Now, I'm curious about path. We had Deepak Chopra on here about purpose and meaning in life. And what's your belief on purpose? Are we put here with a purpose, or do we just randomly find a purpose? What's kind of your sense of it all?
So my sense is that I don't believe in what oftentimes people say, chasing happiness, because happiness is a very fluid up and down cycle in life. And, you know, happiness is not a sustained state, because, you know, things happen and, you know, we get unhappy, we're happy. And we all know that when we're, you know, in midlife, we've lived those cycles. I believe in fulfillment and satisfaction. And fulfillment and satisfaction are getting back to your core self. And I like to say to people, put aside your partner and your kids and your family, because that's sort of hopefully a given. What is it that you, the individual, brings you satisfaction and fulfillment? It may be your family and your kids, and that's great. But aside from that, because cultivating and developing that will bring you the fulfillment that will understand your true purpose in your life. And so that that discovery can be, you know, at different stages in your life and will mean different things to you at different times in your life. When I wrote this book, Roar, this was not necessarily something that was a long thought out thing. I was sort of writing it to create a different voice in what was happening in the second half of life. But ironically, this has now become, you know, one of my, you know, purpose for me. You know, I want to be one of the voices in this space that's saying, you know, destroy the construct you were handed and think about the possibilities that you have in your future. And so purpose sometimes comes out of circumstantial things that you don't necessarily even think about. But if you have a sense of lifelong learning and curiosity, you will find, you know, you will find the purpose that you might be looking for. And so, yeah.
So curiosity, we talk about that a lot here, is like being a curious person, which is a muscle people have to develop, I think, right? It's not something that everyone just has naturally. I mean, I feel like a very curious person. You seem like maybe you're born curious, but it's kind of like, I think what you're saying here is that you better develop that as a muscle. Like, because you'll find more in life. You're going to have to be out there looking around. It's just not going to always be handed to you and put on your lap.
Yeah. And I think a lot of that comes from parenting for those people who are parents, you know, because you're, you know, at this stage, I've got, you know, when I have these, grand nephews, two young boys. And, you know, whenever I'm with them, they live in another city. Whenever I see them, it's always curiosity with a big C. We're always doing little fun things. We're doing surfing lessons and we're doing sports things, but we're also doing, you know, we have this little game in our family called geography where, you know, you sit down and you have 1 minute to write down all the countries in Africa. And then you get, you know, 60 seconds, whoever writes down the most countries. And then we get into a little sort of a conversation about the countries in Africa, or, you know, we sort of do the great mountains, the great rivers, and it sort of opens them up to curiosity about the world. So there are little ways that you can do that. But I think that the curiosity is part of it is developed in you by your parents and your influences. Some of it's natural. But I think that for those people who don't have curiosity when they're 50, I mean, you're forced to have curiosity in the world. Just think about technology and the digital world, and let's not even get into the metaverse. But, you know, just to function as a human being, you have to have curiosity about learning how to be, you know, a digitally proficient, or else you're not going to be able to, you know, get certain fundamental things done, like book an airplane ticket. So, you know, curiosity comes in lots of different forms.
We obviously, the show's called Over the Wall. And if you can think about, you know, when somebody faces the wall, however we want to look at that in their personal life, in their professional life, what advice do you give? What's like the one piece of advice you would give to get over the wall, around the wall, through the wall?
Yeah. I guess the question is how high and how thick is the wall? And I think that's part of the discussion. But it's funny you asked this question. I just saw someone recently who exemplifies this, who I did write about in the book. And he is a 43-year-old man with three young kids who was diagnosed with a very aggressive form of leukemia. And he had to figure out his life. And, you know, an illness, which I would say like that, is a very high and thick wall. Yeah. And the only thing he could do is go deep into the wall. You have to smash right into the wall to get over it. And fortunately, 3 years later, he's healthy and he's good. And he's, you know, he had to turn his world inside out to get to where he was going to go next. So an illness, you know, a devastating natural disaster, you know, something that is epic and existential, a pandemic. Yeah. You know, is a much bigger challenge than somebody crying that they didn't get a promotion.
Right.
You know? I mean, that is not the end of the world. You know, you figure out the why and you navigate around it. So I think there are different gradations of it, and you have to put it into context in terms of how you know, how severe or impactful is this? Mm-hmm. And some things are harder to navigate and get over that wall than others. But I would say put it in context first.
Put it in context. Take a step back. So you're actually seeing what it is. Yeah. What is it that I'm really facing instead of just being like, I guess, overwhelmed by it.
Exactly. That would be the thing that I would say. And also, I think that, you know, putting things in context give great perspective about how you're going to develop the steps to move forward, you know, whether it's your personal life or your work life or whatever. And I think that's, you know, I tell the story of I had an incredible mother who was a reimagineer throughout her entire life, even though she had very limited resources and education. And at, you know, 48 years old, she became a travel agent. She worked free for 6 months to show her mettle, and then they hired her, and she had a 25-year run as that and went all over the world. But at 64, she asked my father for a divorce after 40 years. And there wasn't any other people involved. It's just she decided at 64, her six kids were grown up, that she wanted to live a very different kind of life for the next 20 years than what my father wanted. And she went off and made that decision. And that was a huge decision for a working class woman with no real resources. And, you know, same with my dad. And she lived to, you know, another 25 years and lived the life she wanted to live. My dad ended up living a different life. He got remarried. She didn't. But she would say to her last breath that she was very happy in the last half of her life. But she had the guts to do something that a lot of people don't do. And she just jumped off the big diving board and, you know, scaled that wall.
So you, I guess you're, what you saw in your mother, I assume, did that influence the book writing? Is that also?
Well, you know, it's funny you ask, because I didn't really think of it in that context until I thought about it, because my mother ended up being an ordinary person who lived in an extraordinary life with regards to these decisions that she made during her life. And I didn't really think about it until I thought about it. And then I said, oh, there was sort of an organic influence that we all had that we didn't articulate. And so, so that was, it came out of the process of writing the book.
So I usually like to end with a common question for most of the guests, and I'll ask you the same question, which is that, Is there a gremlin you've had in your head, like a voice in your head, that for most of your life you had to beat? So have you had this voice, or is there a voice in your head you've had to beat your whole life to get where you are?
Well, I think I would probably say that mine would be think bigger. You know, and where I would think big, and many people would say, wow, what you've accomplished, you've really been a big thinker, but yet I step back and I say, I'm not thinking big enough. I'm not thinking big enough about what could be. I'm not thinking big enough about the possibility. I'm not thinking big enough about how I can push myself. So, you know, I celebrated my 60th birthday by running a marathon on Antarctica, you know, and many people would be like, whoa, that is like crazy. Why did you do that? Or how did you do it? You know, just something as simple as that, being able to say, I can do this, you know, I can run this marathon on Antarctica, made me think bigger about my marathon experiences as opposed to just running another street marathon and pick a city. And I ran an adventure marathon in Mongolia, and that was another example. And so in each of the spheres that I'm in, I keep asking myself, why don't you think bigger? Why aren't you thinking bigger? Why aren't you stretching yourself to say you can do this in a bigger way? And so that has always lived with me and continues to do so. And, you know, sometimes I do it and sometimes I don't. And sometimes I have to say, why aren't I doing it? And why aren't I thinking in a bigger way? Thinking bigger is relative to one's individual life, but thinking bigger takes you to new and exciting places that give you experiences and fulfillment that you didn't even know that you wanted to have. And so, you know, that's the beauty and the curiosity of life.
So based on your personal life and things that you've experienced, plus all these people you've met who wrote this book, do you think is there any limit to what you can do?
I don't think there is any limit. Well, okay, you're not going to win a gold medal in the Olympics if you're 50, but you can go do masters, you know, competitions and, you know, senior Olympics or whatever. I'm sure there's some senior Olympics thing. You know, you're probably not going to become Mick Jagger if you're 60, but you can have a whole other gig going on in your life. So I think that there's, you know, one of my favorite stories, I'm going to go back to marathoning. When I ran the Toronto Marathon, I witnessed the first 100-year-old man crossing the finish line of a marathon. Wow. He did not run his first marathon until he was 82. So tell your friend who said he wants to run a marathon. And this guy's name is Fauja Singh. He's still alive. He's 110, but not running marathons anymore. And I say, to me, he is like the beacon of possibility, because things can happen at any time. If you open up your mind, you don't create self-imposed ageism. You don't create self-imposed limitations. You don't live other people's lives, but live your own true North Star. And if you have this idea that you want to write a book, I'm just using that as an example. Yeah. Yeah. You know, Delia Owens, who wrote her first book at 70, which of course I'm forgetting the name of it now, it's been a number one bestseller in the New York Times for over a year. You know, was a great example of someone, you know, who pursued something at any time. So I think it's there. Release yourself to the possibilities.
Fantastic. Michael, I want to thank you for being on the program. Once again, the book is called Roar, a great book. Once again, whether you're in looking at your 50 and above or you're below, it doesn't matter. I didn't think the book was time bound or age bound. Yeah. This is some great words about change and making the change in your life, taking inventory in your life. So I want to thank you for really taking the time to write a book like that. You didn't have to do it. You know, you can continue on doing all the great things you're doing. But I think giving that back as a gift is really phenomenal, and we all appreciate it.
Thanks, Rob. So great to be with you. I really appreciate the conversation and just spending some time with you.
Thank you very much.